Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi, Herman and Corin. I'd love to hear your thoughts upon a very important parenting question for our age, and that is screen use and children. We've heard often, I think, in fact, one of our previous podcasts that got deleted, we were chatting about the general guidelines around screen use. And I guess the reason I'm asking is that sometimes when you're trying to keep we talked about trying to keep our little children occupied and engaged, and sometimes you feel that they need something to be looking at or doing. And that's where I wonder, at what point is it safe? Is it recommended, and is it okay to introduce things like, let's say, watching children's TV or something? I gather that there is some data about this regarding the ages that it's appropriate at, and then some concerns about screens in general, and that they have to be introduced cautiously. So, Herman and Corin, what does the actual data say about this modern parenting question?
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I'm Corin, and I'm sitting here in our living room in Jerusalem with my brother, who has been buried in research papers all morning.
Herman Poppleberry at your service, and you're not wrong. I've been deep in the weeds of developmental psychology today. Our housemate Daniel sent us a prompt that really gets to the heart of modern life, especially for anyone trying to navigate the digital world with little ones around.
Yeah, Daniel was asking about that classic parenting dilemma, screen time. It's such a loaded topic. You see parents at the park or in restaurants, and there's often this palpable tension or even guilt about whether a child should be looking at a tablet or a phone. Daniel specifically wanted to know at what point it's safe or recommended to introduce things like children's television, and what the actual data says about those age-specific concerns.
It's a massive question, Corin, and it's one of those topics where the science is actually quite clear in some areas, but the cultural practice has moved much faster than our understanding of the long-term effects. We're essentially living through a giant, unplanned experiment in human neurobiology.
That's a heavy way to start, but I think it's the right lens. Before we get into the scary stuff, though, let's talk about the baseline. If a parent is exhausted and they just need 20 minutes to cook dinner without a toddler underfoot, the screen feels like a lifesaver. So, when we look at the official guidelines, where do they actually draw the line?
So, the gold standard for these recommendations usually comes from the American Academy of Pediatrics and the World Health Organization. For a long time, their stance was very rigid, no screens at all before age 2. However, they've refined that recently to reflect the reality of the mid-2020s. Currently, the recommendation is essentially zero screen time for children under 18 months, with one very specific exception, video chatting.
That's interesting. Why is video chatting okay, but a cartoon is not? To a 1-year-old, it's all just glowing pixels on a glass pane, right?
You would think so, but the brain sees it differently. The exception for video chatting is because it's socially contingent. When grandma's on the screen and she says the baby's name and waits for a reaction, that's a back-and-forth exchange. It's a social connection. The data suggests that even very young infants can perceive that social responsiveness. But a television show, no matter how educational it claims to be, is a one-way street. It's passive.
Okay, so 18 months is the first hurdle. What happens after that? Does the floodgate just open?
Not exactly. From 18 to 24 months, the recommendation is that if you want to introduce digital media, it should be high-quality programming and, crucially, it should be watched with a parent. They call this co-viewing. The idea is that the parent is there to translate what's happening on the screen into the real world. If a character on the screen is eating an apple, the parent says, "Look, he's eating a red apple, just like the one we had for lunch."
So the parent acts as a bridge. That makes sense. But I imagine the challenge is that the screen is often used specifically so the parent can do something else. The co-viewing requirement kind of defeats the purpose of the digital babysitter.
That's the key thing, and that's where the tension lies. Then, from ages 2 to 5, the recommendation is generally capped at 1 hour per day of high-quality programming. But here's the thing, Corn. Even that 1 hour is framed as something that should be intentional, not just background noise.
I want to dig into the why. Why are these experts so cautious about those first 2 years in particular? What's actually happening in the toddler's brain when they're staring at a screen?
It comes down to something called the video deficit effect. This is a well-documented phenomenon where children under the age of 2 or 3 learn significantly less from a video than they do from a live demonstration. There was a famous study where researchers showed toddlers a video of someone hiding a toy in the room they were sitting in. Most of the children could not find the toy after watching the video. But if they saw the person hide it in real life, through a window or right in front of them, they found it instantly.
That's fascinating. So their brains literally can't translate two-dimensional information into three-dimensional reality yet.
Precisely. Their symbolic thinking hasn't kicked in fully. To them, the person on the screen is just a series of lights and colors, not a representation of a human doing a thing in space. So, when a company sells a DVD and claims it will teach your baby sign language or foreign words, the data shows it usually doesn't work. In fact, some studies have shown that for every hour of certain baby media watched, infants actually knew fewer words than their peers who didn't watch it.
Wait, really? It actually hindered their vocabulary?
In some specific contexts, yes. And the reason is what we call the displacement effect. This is a huge part of the concern. If a child is staring at a screen for an hour, that's an hour where they're not babbling with a parent, not stacking blocks, and not exploring the physical properties of their environment. Language development in humans is deeply tied to social interaction and physical feedback. A screen provides neither.
I remember reading about the still face experiment. It wasn't about screens originally, but it feels relevant here.
Oh, it is incredibly relevant. For those who don't know, the still face experiment was conducted by Edward Tronick in the 1970s. A mother would interact with her baby normally, and then she would suddenly go completely expressionless, a still face. The baby would try everything to get a reaction, then eventually collapse into distress. When a parent is staring at their own phone, or when a baby is staring at a screen, you're essentially creating a digital version of the still face. The rich, responsive feedback loop that builds a child's brain is interrupted.
So it's not just what the screen is doing to them. It's what the screen is taking away from them. But what about the content itself? Does it matter if they're watching a slow-paced show like Mr. Rogers versus something really fast and flashy?
It matters immensely, and this is where the modern data gets really interesting. There's a lot of discussion right now about something called overstimulation or sensory overload. Some modern children's shows, like Cocomelon, are edited with extremely fast cuts, bright colors, and constant loud noises. Every few seconds, something new happens to grab the child's attention.
I've seen those. They're almost hypnotic. You see a kid watching them and they're completely frozen, eyes wide, mouth open.
That's the orienting reflex. Their brain is being forced to pay attention to the new stimulus because the brain is wired to notice changes in the environment for survival. But when you trigger that reflex every 3 seconds, you're essentially hijacking the child's dopamine system. Their brain gets used to that level of high-intensity input. Then, when the screen turns off and they're looking at a wooden block that just sits there, it feels boring. Their brain is understimulated by reality.
That explains the epic meltdowns when the tablet is taken away. It's like a tiny withdrawal.
It literally is. There's research, including a major 2024 study in JAMA Pediatrics, suggesting that high exposure to fast-paced media in early childhood is linked to atypical sensory processing. It can lead to shorter attention spans and difficulties with executive function later on. Executive function is the brain's ability to plan, focus, and multitask. If you train a brain to only respond to external, flashy stimuli, it struggles to develop the internal ability to sustain focus on something that's not entertaining it every second.
So, if a parent is going to introduce television, the advice would be to go for the slow stuff. The shows where a character talks slowly, pauses for a response, and the camera stays still for more than 5 seconds.
That's right. Shows like Bluey, Puffin Rock, or Trash Truck are often praised because they model social play and have a more natural pace. Think of the old school Sesame Street or Mr. Rogers. There's a reason those worked. They were designed by developmental psychologists to match the processing speed of a child's brain.
I want to go back to something you mentioned earlier. You said that the label educational can be misleading. Can we talk about the baby Einstein phenomenon? I feel like that was a huge turning point in how we thought about screens.
That's a perfect example of misconception. Busting. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, the Baby Einstein videos were a massive cultural hit. Parents believed that by exposing their infants to classical music and simple shapes on a screen, they were giving them a cognitive head start. But in 2007, a study out of the University of Washington found that for every hour of these videos infants watched, they actually understood 6 to 8 fewer words than infants who didn't watch them.
6 to 8 fewer words? That's a significant hit.
It was a bombshell. It eventually led to Disney, who had bought the company, offering refunds to parents. The takeaway was not necessarily that the videos were toxic, but that they were being used as a substitute for human interaction. Parents thought the video was doing the work of teaching, so they would step away. But babies don't learn from videos, they learn from people.
This brings up an interesting second-order effect. If screens are so prevalent, it's not just the kid's screen time that matters, right? It's the parent's screen time, too.
You hit on a very important concept called technoference. This term, coined by researcher Brandon McDaniel, describes how often parents are interrupted by their phones while playing with their children. Even small interruptions, like checking a text, broke the flow of the interaction. When those interruptions are frequent, children tend to exhibit more behavioral issues, like being more whiny or prone to outbursts. They're essentially competing with the phone for their parents' attention.
It's like we're all part of this distracted ecosystem. I want to look at the other side of this, though. We live in a world where digital literacy is essential. Is there an argument to be made that early exposure helps them navigate the world they're actually going to grow up in?
That's the argument many people make, but the data doesn't really support it for the very young. A 2-year-old doesn't need to learn how to swipe a screen to be tech savvy at age 10. Those interfaces are designed to be intuitive. They can learn them in 5 minutes when they're older. The foundational skills they need for a digital world are not actually digital. They are social and cognitive. They need empathy, focus, and the ability to solve problems in the physical world. Those are the prerequisites for being a healthy adult in any environment, digital or otherwise.
So the best way to prepare a kid for a world of AI and screens is to let them play in the dirt and talk to them.
Honestly, yes. One of the most interesting things I found in the research is the impact on sleep. This is a very concrete data point. We know that blue light from screens suppresses melatonin, the hormone that helps us sleep. But for children, the effect is even more pronounced because their eyes have larger pupils and clearer lenses, letting in more light. A study published in the journal Pediatrics showed that screen time was directly correlated with shorter sleep duration and later bedtimes in toddlers. And we know that sleep is when the brain does its heavy lifting for development and memory consolidation.
And if the kid isn't sleeping, the parents aren't sleeping, and then everyone's executive function goes out the window. It's a vicious cycle.
It really is. So, to answer Daniel's question about when it's safe, the answer is that it's a sliding scale. Before 18 months, the safest amount is basically 0, except for talking to relatives. From 18 months to 2 years, it should be very limited and very social. And even as they get older, the goal should be to keep screens as a tool for specific purposes rather than a background presence.
What about the physical development side? I've heard people talk about the impact on vision and even posture.
There's a massive rise in myopia, or nearsightedness, globally. While genetics play a role, many researchers point to the lack of outdoor time and the increase in near work, which includes looking at screens. When you're outside, your eyes are constantly shifting focus from near to far, and you're exposed to natural light, which helps the eye develop correctly. If a child is staring at a screen 10 inches from their face for hours, that natural development is disrupted.
Okay, let's get practical. We've laid out a pretty daunting picture of the risks, but we also know that parents are human and the world is demanding. What are some strategies for introducing screens in a way that minimizes these risks?
First and foremost, I think it's about intentionality. Instead of having the TV on in the background all day, make it an event. We're going to watch this 120-minute episode of this specific show, and then the TV goes off. This helps prevent the screen from becoming a default state of being.
And I imagine having screen-free zones is part of that?
Yes, that's crucial. The dinner table and bedrooms should be strictly screen-free. There's a lot of data showing that having a TV in a child's bedroom is associated with higher risks of obesity, poor sleep, and lower academic performance later on. It's just too much of a distraction from the primary tasks of childhood.
What about the content selection itself? If a parent is looking at a sea of options on a streaming service, what should they be looking for?
Look for shows with a clear narrative arc, characters that speak directly to the viewer with pauses for response, and a slower pace of editing. Avoid anything that feels like a sensory assault. Also, check for educational content that is actually vetted by experts, like PBS Kids in the United States or similar public broadcasters. They tend to have much stricter guidelines than random YouTube channels.
YouTube seems like a whole different beast. The algorithms there are designed to keep you watching, which seems like the exact opposite of what a toddler needs.
YouTube is the Wild West of screen time. The autoplay feature is particularly dangerous for kids because it removes the natural stopping point. A child doesn't have the self-regulation to say, "Okay, I've had enough." The screen just keeps feeding them more. For young children, curated platforms where the parent has total control over what is next are much safer than algorithmic ones.
You mentioned earlier that the parent should be a bridge. How does that look in practice for a 3 or 4-year-old?
It's called active mediation. It means asking questions while you watch. Why do you think the character did that? What do you think will happen next? Look at the color of that bird. This turns a passive experience into an active, linguistic one. It keeps the social brain engaged even while the child is looking at a screen.
It sounds like the key is to treat the screen as a shared activity rather than an isolation chamber.
That's it. And that leads to another important point, modeling. Children are incredibly observant. If they see their parents constantly on their phones, they're going to view that as the most important and desirable activity in the world. We can't tell a child to put down the tablet if we can't put down our phones.
That's the hardest part for most of us, I think. It's a challenge for everyone in the house, not just the kids.
It really is. And I think we should also mention the importance of boredom. This is something we've almost eliminated in the modern world. But boredom is the precursor to creativity. When a child is bored, they have to use their imagination to find something to do. If we immediately hand them a screen every time they're restless, we're robbing them of the opportunity to develop that internal resource.
I love that. Boredom is a feature, not a bug. It's like the brain's way of saying, okay, it's time to build something new.
Right. There's a great quote by developmental psychologists that play is the work of childhood. And most digital media is not play, it is consumption. There's a world of difference between playing a creative game like Minecraft, where you're building and problem-solving, and passively watching unboxing videos on YouTube.
That's a great distinction. Even within screen time, there's a hierarchy. Active, creative use is better than passive consumption.
Definitely. But even then, for the very young, the physical world is the best playground. Think about the sensory richness of playing with water or sand. You have the temperature, the texture, the weight, the way it moves. A screen can simulate the look of water, but it cannot give the brain those other 4 dimensions of information. Those sensory inputs are what actually build the neural pathways in the somatosensory cortex.
So, looking back at the data Daniel asked about, the concerns are not just about some vague idea of screens being bad. They are about specific developmental milestones: language, executive function, physical health, and social-emotional learning that are all being influenced by this one variable.
That's right. And it's important to remember that the brain is at its most plastic in those first 5 years. The pathways that are formed during this time are the foundation for everything else. It's not that a child will be ruined by watching some TV, but rather that we want to ensure the vast majority of their experiences are the high-quality, real-world interactions that their brains are literally built to require.
It feels like the takeaway here is one of balance and intentionality. It's not about being a Luddite or banning technology, but about understanding that technology is a powerful tool that needs to be introduced with a lot of care, especially when the user is still learning how to be a person.
That's a perfect way to put it. We should treat screens more like a powerful medication or a complex tool. You wouldn't give a toddler a power drill, not because drills are evil, but because they don't have the coordination or the judgment to use one safely yet. Screens are a cognitive and emotional power tool.
I think this also brings up the idea of the second order effects on the family dynamic. When we use screens to keep kids quiet, we might be missing out on those small, often annoying, but vital moments of conflict resolution and emotional regulation.
Yes, learning how to handle being told no, or learning how to wait for something, or learning how to interact with a sibling when you're both bored. Those are the social skills that determine your success in life. If a screen is always used to bypass those moments of friction, the child never gets to practice those skills.
It's like a muscle that never gets exercised because we're using a digital exoskeleton.
That's a great analogy. And we see the results of that later in life. There's a lot of concern among educators right now about students who struggle with resilience and interpersonal communication. Many people are looking back at the childhoods of these generations and seeing a significant increase in screen time and a decrease in unsupervised imaginative play.
It's a lot to think about. And I think for Daniel and any other parents listening, the goal should not be perfection. That's impossible in the world we live in. But being informed by this data allows you to make better choices when you do decide to use screens.
Right. If you know that the 30 minutes of TV your kid is watching is displacing 30 minutes of play, you might make sure that the rest of their afternoon is extra hands-on. You can use the data to balance the digital diet.
I like that term, digital diet. It makes it feel more manageable, like nutrition. You can have some dessert, but you need your vegetables too.
That's it. And the vegetables of childhood are talking, playing, and exploring the physical world.
Well, Herman, I think we've thoroughly explored the depths of this one. It's a topic that touches almost every household today.
It really does. And the research is ongoing. We're going to know a lot more in another 10 years, but for now, the cautious approach seems to be the most scientifically sound one.
Before we wrap up, I just want to say, if you're enjoying these deep dives, we would really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on your favorite podcast app. It genuinely helps other people find the show.
It really does help. And thank you to Daniel for the prompt. It's a great reminder that the most common parts of our lives are often the ones that warrant the most investigation.
Definitely. You can find all our past episodes, including some where we talk about the broader impacts of technology on society, at myweirdprompts.com. We also have an RSS feed there if you want to subscribe directly.
This has been My Weird Prompts. We're glad you joined us for this exploration of the digital nursery.
Until next time, I'm Korn.
And I'm Herman Poppleberry.
Take care, everyone.
Goodbye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.